Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It is a troubling thought for accomplished young women that men might prefer to marry down rather than up or even sideways, that, as a recent University of Michigan study finds, college-age men looking for long-term relationships would rather marry secretaries than bosses. For ambitious career women looking for success and a mate, this is not a pretty picture. And it's not the world a generation of feminists fought for, a world where empowered women would be embraced on the business front and the home front, a world where high achievement would be desirable in life and in marriage. Yes, Hollywood perpetuates the image of powerful men marrying their nannies, assistants, and wedding planners, and maybe it's bunk. But maybe it's not. Tonight on Point, the buzz over new claims that men don't want high-achieving women, that they don't want the women we've been working so hard to raise. You can join the conversation tonight. What's going on here? Have you seen the pattern? Do you buy the study, the conclusion, the complaint? Are men not made for equal partners, more than equal? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Susan Shapiro Barish, author of several books about gender and relationships, including The New Wife, The Evolving Role of the American Wife. She teaches critical thinking and gender studies at Marymount Manhattan College. Susan Shapiro Barish, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So here we are. You've been writing about this for a long time, but a lot of us have just been brought in the last couple months and maybe the last couple of days. We've got this University of Michigan study published in the Journal of Evolution and Human Behavior. Sounds like a big deal. And the co-author says that their findings provide empirical support for the widespread belief that powerful men are at a disadvantage in the marriage market, or women, powerful women, I should say, at a disadvantage in the marriage market because men may prefer to marry less accomplished women. And we've got folks up in arms about it. First of all, do you believe it, Susan?
Well, yes. I've interviewed thousands of women for my studies on women as wives, and I do see a trend. And I think what happens is so ironic because women today are more educated than ever before, and they really want to have it all. And the men are still very much invested in the patriarchal society, and I think that they find it threatening in many instances.
And so just yesterday we've got Maureen Dowd jumping in on this in her column. Mm-hmm. And, of course, her language and claws are always exquisitely sharp and pointed. She says, look around, look at the movies. Spanglish is out now with Adam Sandler. He falls for the maid who cleans up after him without being able to speak English. She's presented as the ideal woman. His wife, played by Tia Leone, is repellent, Maureen Dowd says, a jangly, yakking, overachieving, overexercised. On you go, shallow she-monster. What are women supposed to take away from this? I mean, the whole message has been go out and accomplish things. You're equals now.
I think it's been very difficult for women, and I did read this column, and I see exactly what she's saying, and I did see Spanglish. And, you know, her point is well made and well taken, and I think the problem is that men have had such trouble catching up with women, and the world for women has so changed and has brought so many choices and options in the last 40 years, and men had no modeling. They really didn't know how to keep up with the women.
Keep up, but, I mean, they already knew accomplished men. Was it so hard to look over and see women in those same roles? They surely wouldn't walk away from accomplished men as friends or companions. Why walk away from an accomplished woman?
Well, I think initially they didn't, because when we considered the feminist movement and what ensued afterward, what we saw was women in the early 70s till the mid-80s believing that they could have husbands, houses, children, and careers, and that everything would go smoothly. But in fact, these women were very stressed and very distracted and trying to balance everything, and the husbands often got short shrift. And I think that what Maureen Dowd is writing about is men who are reacting to that.
She cites a British study, another one, came out last week, suggesting that smart men with demanding jobs would rather have old-fashioned wives like their mums rather than equals. And then this finding in the British study, that high IQ hampers a woman's chance to get married while it's a plus for men. They found the prospect for marriage is increased by 35% for guys for each 16-point increase in IQ. For women, a 40% drop for each 16-point rise in IQ. I mean, that just seems, that seems cruel. It seems almost ridiculous.
Well, it really diminishes a woman. And what's so terrific about the world today for women is just what they can do with their hard-earned degrees. And so there is this, like, backlash to the future, if you will, where men have tried their best, and a lot of those marriages failed. I mean, 3 out of 4 women instigate divorces, and they're very disappointed in the marriages. So the men are almost being protective.
You've really got to help me with some examples here, because I must say I know an awful lot of men who are married to women who are very much their equals. Now, I don't know what generation we're talking about here exactly, and I see a lot of marriages there that work. I mean, nothing against secretaries and assistants and all the rest, you know, terrific, but is this a kind of exaggeration? I mean, aren't there a lot of American men who are married to women who are their equal in education and, by now, accomplishment?
Well, I think that marriage is such a mystery to all of us. I mean, we so covet the role of wife, and women truly want to be married. But you never know. You know, you take this vow and things change. So perhaps the man who really feels he and his wife are in law school together, and then they'll both be partners at a firm, it all seems fine. And then she becomes the star, and suddenly he's not as comfortable with it, or she earns more money. You know, the major breadwinner being a wife is often very kind of threatening to the man.
So this picture in the movies of the guys, you know, sort of the, going all the way back to almost like the Pretty Woman model, or what was it a couple of years ago, Love Actually, where the prime minister marries the tea and scones girl. That's really happening?
Well, it's not the only thing that happens. And actually, there are other ways for it to play out. I think that each decade of women, you know, say women who were our Generation X women, they have a very different take on it. They worked very hard, and some woke up at 38 or so and said, wait a second, I have this terrific career. I've achieved a great deal, but I don't have a husband and a child. And then they scurried to marry, and then they were very worried about, you know, would they be able to conceive and have children? So I think that, you know, we're talking about how men perceive wives, but also what women are thinking now today.
What are you saying, that they are not finding the mates they want? At once they've accomplished all that, they're not finding the guys who they want to settle down with?
I'm saying that it's been so difficult for women to navigate a path where they can have a successful career, where they don't hit the glass ceiling, where their dreams are really recognized, where having a husband and a child, particularly children, doesn't somehow stymie them. Because the truth is that even if both husband and wife are working, if it's a dual working couple, the responsibilities of childcare really do still fall upon the wife.
You know, this University of Michigan study has gotten a lot of pushback as well, and especially, I think, because here it is appearing in the Journal of Evolution and Human Behavior, and it's presented as something that's not just, that hasn't just come out of, I don't know, the gender relationships of the last 20 years. It's presented as something that may be all the way deep down in the sort of evolutionary code of men. They wrote in the Michigan study, pressures associated with the threat of paternal uncertainty shape men's decision. That is, female infidelity is a severe reproductive threat to males, and males support or see infidelity as more likely among powerful women. Do you see this as more, if it's a fact, as more a phenomenon of our moment in history, or something that really could be that deeply evolutionarily planted?
Well, in terms of female infidelity, which is one of my studies and one of my books, I believe it's not only on the rise, but that a part of it is about women in the workplace, because they now trade in the same currency as do men. You know, they travel for work, they have a credit card, they can have a boy toy, if you will. And so do women have affairs more than ever before? Yes. And were men, again, in our patriarchy, excused for that? Yes. So it is very threatening to men.
And where do you see this kicking in? I don't know, take college grads, for example. In the immediate years after college, a time when they might well be marrying, are American men already looking away from the women they've just graduated with? Are they looking elsewhere? Or is this in second marriages? Where does it show up?
Well, Tom, if you're talking about women who are actually Generation Y women, young women in their 20s, who are graduating from college today, I see a new shift. I see something really curious happening. And that is that these young women and their boyfriends, you know, who will be their husbands, are the children of the baby boomer mother. And there was no more disenchanted woman in the last 40 or 50 years than the baby boomer mother, because she really did buy into the myth of having it all, and she really couldn't have it, and it was the highest divorce rate by the early 80s in America.
So how's her daughter responding to that?
Well, her daughter is actually looking, you know, really looking closely at her mother. She's scrutinizing her mother, and she's saying, gee, you know, look at my grandmother, a 50s wife. She's still married to my grandfather, if he's alive. Mm-hmm. And she's really... It has a much less stressful, you know, sort of easier life. And then she looks at her mother and she sees all that her mother endured to have the career incorporated into her life. And so the deal that she's cutting with this young man is saying, look, you know, all right, we both went to law school, but I want our marriage to last. I don't want anything to get in the way. And I want to have children young. And so they're getting married younger. They're having children sooner. And this woman is really forfeiting her education and what she's capable of doing, at least for the time being, in order to have a more successful family life.
And in that very young generation, is she also saying to the man, fear not, I'm not going to threaten you? Or is this younger American male not as worried about that?
No, I don't think that she's quite secretary type in her thinking. She actually has a very notable confidence that this will all work out. She even believes she can just get back to the workplace. Well, the wives of the last 25 years who were working were threatened. They were afraid to take maternity leave.
Right.
They, you know, and that goes back to why men would want someone who, you know, doesn't have as many expectations for herself. Just a lot easier all around.
Susan Shapiro Barash, stand by. I got to bring into our conversation Stephen Rhodes. He joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. He's author of Taking Sex Differences Seriously. He's professor of politics at the University of Virginia. Stephen Rhodes, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's a great pleasure, Tom.
You don't hesitate to come into this from the evolutionary side, and you say, this is nature's way, that of course men aren't looking for women who are going to challenge them. Have I got you right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I do think evolution has a lot to do with it. I also think a lot to do with testosterone. And it's not just they're worried about straying partners. I mean, you have to remember, this Michigan study said, how would you feel about marrying someone who's responsible for disciplining you? This is the way it's introduced. And, you know, men don't like to be disciplined, and they don't by their wives. So I think they are turned off in a way by someone. If the picture is someone who's a real hard charger, who's a kind of assertive and aggressive and so on, that doesn't seem feminine. And, you know, hard-charging women are attracted to hard-charging men because that's masculine. But hard-charging man might want something very different.
Now, but when you start to get into that level of analysis, it seems to really be a line that wants to pull the rug out from underneath the women of the post-women's liberation era, all those feminist aspirations.
Well, I don't think so. I think it's a time thing. I really liked a lot of what Susan said. I think she's got the trends exactly right. And I think... a lot of women are much more sensible now. They're realizing, you know, you don't have to do everything at once. It really isn't possible. And they're also realizing, you know, I'm a great law student and he's a great law student, but I'm a lot better with babies than he is. I mean, that's just a fact. That's one of them, that if you have more testosterone, you're less interested in babies.
But it sounds like Little House on the Prairie all over again.
Well,
I mean, it sounds like a big insult to women who want to go out and do things in the world, be doctors, lawyers, change the world.
Well, just for a time. You know, I mean, we live to be 70 and 80, and I think part of the thing that plays into this is that, you know, the latest evidence on breastfeeding, how important that is, and, gee, how do I work 50 hours a week and breastfeed? And then the latest evidence on daycare, which is very problematic, and I think men and women are, forget evolution, a lot of them are saying, you know, why do I need all this stress? You make a good income for 7 or 8 years. I can take care of these wonderful kids, which I love a whole lot, and then go on with my career. So I don't think it's so much that men don't like educated, witty, intelligent women. Although I know that one study Maureen mentioned, but what might be happening there is that women don't like men who are less intelligent than they are.
Stephen Rhodes, we've got to take a short break. Susan Shapiro Barash will be right back. We're talking about the new buzz over claims that men don't want high-achieving women. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We are in it all, you and me. Falling in man.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the buzz over new claims that men don't want high-achieving women, that they don't want the women we've been working so hard to raise. What do you think? What's going on here? Are men, in fact, avoiding high-powered women in favor of secretaries, assistants, nannies, party planners? Superwomen, do you feel at a disadvantage in the mating game? Do men really prefer unchallenging women who will essentially just take care of them? The headline on Maureen Dowd's column in the New York Times yesterday, Men Just Want Mommy. Do you buy it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Charlottesville, Virginia, by Stephen Rhodes, author of Taking Sex Differences Seriously, professor at University of Virginia, and from New York by Susan Shapiro Barash, author of The New Wife, The Evolving Role of the American Wife. She teaches gender studies and critical thinking at Marymount Manhattan College. Let's get a caller in here right away. Lauren's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a couple of comments.
Please.
I'm a 26-year-old doing a double master's program, and one of them is an MBA, so I'm in a male-dominated environment. And I was listening to your comments on the Michigan study, which I'm not familiar with the specifics, but I wanted to say that I think the age of the people surveyed is important, because if these guys are undergraduates, then there's a certain percentage that are not of marrying age.
So they don't even know what they're talking
exactly.
about, you're saying.
So if you're going to survey them again when they're 30, they may have come full circle on this issue.
What do you find in your MBA circle, Lauren? Do you look around and see men who appear to be, I don't know, averting their eyes from you because you're just too powerful, or do you see real potential marriage partners there?
I don't see any problems with it at all, actually. Personally, I want to do something different than a lot of my peers, so I don't see marriage partners. But, you know, I've gotten asked out on plenty of dates. There are plenty of men in my program who are married to women who also have graduate degrees. And my sister has a PhD from Stanford. Her husband has an MBA from Stanford. And,
yeah. You
know, there's not a conflict there either. So, which is the second point I wanted to make, which I think is some of it is also related to income. People who are able to go into things like graduate programs or go into industries where there are women in powerful positions also have more exposure to women who are powerful, and they, you know, are more comfortable with it as a result.
So you're not buying it, and I hear that. Stephen Rhodes, here's a caller who says, look, I'm an MBA student. I look around. I don't see this happening. Maybe this Michigan study is just of, boys, undergraduate men who just don't know enough about the world yet. When they get out there, they'll want accomplished women.
Well, I think one thing we should bring into the discussion is what women want, because I think the part of the answer is you can't just blame men for patriarchy. Women do like men who are more intelligent than they are. I mean, there's one study of med students who say, you know, they want their mate, a third of them, say, to make more money than I do. This woman's going to be a doctor. This kind of limits their choices. And I think women like powerful men. They are attracted to them. There's another Maureen Dowd column at the time of the Clinton impeachment that made a big deal of this, but she called it a new breed of feminist erotic literature, because all these professional women were saying, oh, yeah, boy, Clinton, he's really hot because he's so powerful. And so it doesn't work just one way. I think there is more tension in marriages. There's definitely more divorce in marriages where the woman makes more money than the man. And I don't think it's necessarily just because of what's going on in the man's mind.
Susan Shapiro Barash, are you buying that? If women want powerful men, intelligent men, is that a reason they wouldn't be equally intelligent and powerful?
I think that Stephen is making a valid point, and I do believe that there are women, as successful as they are, who feel that their husbands have to be at least as successful or more successful. And if not, they, and this is the curious part to me, they almost resent it. And they resent it because they're, you know, what they've been exposed to in our culture is resonant. You know, it still resonates with them. And they still, you know, experience all these mixed messages for women. And so they still want that very traditional role. But having a smart man is very sexy to women. There's no question.
But surely not only to secretaries. It must be sexy to smart women as well.
Of course.
Stephen Rhodes, we can't keep away from the politics here. I've seen you quoted in the National Review, conservative magazine, saying the culture wars are really about the role of women. And I don't know if this is the way you intend it. Maybe it is. But it seems like a number of conservative commentators have taken your research and held it up to say the feminist movement was all wrong. Women's liberation was a big mistake. We need to get back to, you know, homemaking.
Well, I think it would be wrong if they said that. But I am all in favor of more opportunities for women. But I agree with Susan that women on the ground are saying, you know, the 70s overdid it, this idea you can do everything at once. and kind of androgynous idea of marriage, for example, isn't working out. Once babies come, it's clear mom is better with babies than dad is, and the whole idea of why don't we all do everything equally disappears. I think that it's clear that women care most about relationships in all aspects of their life. Even unmarried women care more about relationships with friends and mother than their careers. And therefore, they want this marriage to work, and they want their kids. They put kids in marriage first. And they say, if you ask them, 93% say, my kids make me happy all or most of the time. 90% say that about their husband. 60% say that about their jobs.
But they're raised, many American women are raised today to achieve just as much as they can, educationally and in career terms, Susan. I mean, is that someone here, maybe Maureen Dowd, says, asks the question, was the feminist movement some sort of cruel hoax? I mean, you know, as a man, I couldn't even raise it if she hadn't asked it. And I don't really believe it, but is that what this is suggesting?
Well, I think that the feminist movement was so important, and it is disturbing to me that so many young women today don't appreciate just what they fought for, and the choices wouldn't be available to women today if it hadn't been for that movement. But I think what is so tricky for women and for men is just what the new modeling is. And men, as I said before, have always been playing catch-up. They don't really know what to do because their roles have remained very similar for these last 40 years. And in fact, if we look at the 90s, those marriages were called egalitarian marriages. Mm-hmm. And there were stay-at-home husbands and home offices and all these hopes that it would work out. And in fact, the women were devastated by the fact that the husbands just couldn't come on board. It was
couldn't come on board. Meaning what?
That they would yes their wives. They would say, I mean, I interviewed women where they both had important meetings and little Johnny had a play recital. And they really fought it out over who would give up the meeting to show up in the school auditorium. And obviously the women do more because that's really what they've been trained to do. And the other was added on, the idea of career. But it isn't so easy for the men or the women. But the men have not been in step in the past, even the recent past.
Let's get another call here. Rosalind is calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Rosalind. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a couple of points. With all due respect to the speakers, we're hearing a lot of anecdotes about this case or that case when there is really a huge body of empirical literature that bears directly on some of the issues that were raised.
So let's hear it. I mean, we're turning to this University of Michigan study, but we're open to more.
Okay, well, there's a lot, because that University of Michigan study, which I'm very familiar with, doesn't cite a lot of this literature. For one thing, men, in fact, are marrying women who have more education, not less education. The more education women have, the more marriageable they are. This is results of a major study by Professor Valerie Kincaid Oppenheimer from Berkeley.
Okay.
It's also true that men's roles have not stayed the same. First of all, their wages have been stagnant or declining for a number of years, and they are looking, because we need two incomes now in this culture to provide for women who can earn their way.
Mm-hmm.
And those are marriages. 42% of marriages now, the women are earning more than their husbands, and there's no indication that divorce is higher. In fact,
42% and divorce no higher.
That's right. And in one study, it turned out divorce rates were highest among couples in which the wives had no earnings.
So you're pushing straight back against the whole Michigan finding and saying, no, it just isn't so.
Well, there's a lot more. I mean, just for example, in the Michigan study, the other hypothesis they tested, also in evolutionary, the other side of it is that women would want to date or mate with more powerful, dominant men. And they found absolutely no data in their study that show any effect for women. And, in fact, the finding that's being touted so widely was, in conventional psychological research terms, barely a marginally significant finding.
So let me ask you, Rosalind, you seem really well clued in here. How do you interpret all this, the sort of Hollywood motif we see today? It's not Tracy and Hepburn of half a century ago with that, you know, as Maureen Dowd said, the snap between equals. It's the marrying down. Here you've got Maureen Dowd all up in arms about it, the Times putting it on the front page, all kinds of publications picking this up. How do you interpret, I don't know, maybe in political terms, the buzz?
I think that the story about gender difference is a big seller, no matter who says it about what. And there's very little scrutiny about how accurate the data are or how carefully the results are interpreted. It's sort of picked up and it sort of comes into the the language
mm-hmm.
as if it's a real established fact. These were 18-year-old college students. this is a hypothetical situation where all they were doing is responding to stereotypes about, quote, dominant, close quote, women. Well, no one's going to find a dominant woman very attractive. But if you,
why not?
Well, not an 18-year-old who doesn't have any firsthand experience. You know, doesn't say anything about actual marriage choice. I concur with the first caller who said that these same young people may do a turnaround when they're out in the real world and have real experience and need to form a partnership with a partner who can contribute economically as well as in other ways to a family.
Rosalind, you're giving us a valuable earful here. Stephen Rhodes, how about it? Here's pushback from somebody who knows a broader field of studies and says, you know, this one study, this laser beam of attention isn't justified when you look around.
Well, certainly she's right about the one study, and she's also right about that study that more educated women are more marriageable. So I don't think it's mainly education so much as it is dominance-seeking. But it's still the case, and everything I've seen, that women don't like marriages in which they are dominant, which means they get their way most of the time. I think men tend to tune out. I don't agree that when women make more money, they're not more divorce prone. I think those marriages are more divorce prone. And I think the other thing that is important your callers know, it's not just based on theories of evolutionary psychology, the position I come from. It's based on looking at high testosterone women and noticing they're less interested in babies, they're more interested in careers, they're more interested in casual sex. They are different and more like men in a whole host of ways. And there's somewhere between men and women, and there's all kinds of evidence that women, that testosterone makes a lot of difference in these differences, and it comes up particularly in marriages when the babies come, because men are bored by babies, and women are not bored by babies.
I want to come back to our clued-in caller here, Rosalind. Rosalind, here's another line of attack. What do you make of it?
Well, first of all, testosterone is a very complicated hormone. It doesn't act simply, and there's no data. There's been a huge review in the United Kingdom of studies on the effect of testosterone on behavior, and there's no compelling evidence that has any direct effect on any kind of behavior. In fact, if you look at, if you imagine that testosterone is associated with aggression, in studies when men have won, you know, basketball teams or whatever, the testosterone is higher after the game than before the game. It may be maybe higher as a result of, but not a driver of. It's a very complicated thing. You cannot make any simple connections. And the statement that Stephen Rhodes just made, that men don't like babies, is blatantly false. There's all kinds of data to refute that. We're talking here comparing, you know, anecdotes. You can always find, you know, Joe or Dick who doesn't feel comfortable with a baby. And a very substantial body of peer-reviewed literature that counters this, each of these points, point by point by point.
Is this Rosalind Barnett I'm speaking
yes,
with?
Yes, it is.
So you wrote a book with Carol Rivers.
Correct.
Same difference, how gender myths are hurting our relationships, our children, and our jobs.
Right. Based on a review of about 1,500 peer-reviewed empirical studies done by all kinds of people. I've done a little of this work myself, and I did a major study funded by the National Institute of Mental Health of two runner couples. And I've analyzed those data in terms of what happens when she earns more than he earns over time.
So you really think this is all kind of anecdotal stuff that's built up into a trend?
Well, what we're talking about here is, and that study is one study. It has to be evaluated on its merits. It's a flawed study in a lot of ways, and it doesn't address the point about what kind of women men who are in the marriage game are looking for.
Stephen Rhodes, there's a big challenge to your testosterone theory.
Well, it is. And Carol Rivers and I have actually debated, and I've enjoyed those, but I must say we're not talking about aggression, and we're talking about nurturing. There are studies that show if you inject a mother monkey with testosterone, she loses interest in her baby. If you look in Sweden and you look at men who say, I want to take parental leave right after the baby's born, and I want to be the principal caretaker of this baby. And then they go in and they find out what's going on in those homes, and the mother is doing most of the nurturing.
But are you saying that an ambitious, highly accomplished woman is some kind of, you know, testosterone-driven monster?
Oh, well, she's certainly not a monster, but I do think that there's definitely high testosterone women are different. It's especially it comes up in the womb. In other words, exposure in the womb is, look, a wonderful study by a guy who looks at testosterone samples taken while this woman who's now 25 was in utero, and finds that when she's exposed to more testosterone in utero, after controlling for all socialization variables, she's somewhat more masculine. She's more interested in careers, less interested in babies. And it's hard to say how that's socialization because, you know, nobody was socializing her in the womb.
Rosalind Barnett, I want to give you one more swing here. This is a pretty big divide opened up here.
Well, I just don't even know where to start. I think, first of all, the decision about having children, whether you want children or not, is a function of the finances, the opportunity cost of having children. If anything, the trend in the European industrialized countries and this country is having smaller families. It doesn't mean women have more testosterone, therefore they want smaller families. That's silly. There are a lot of factors that go into the decision about whether to have children or not to have children. Far beyond testosterone, which I said before, is a complex hormone. In fact, it's produced by women naturally also, although at lower levels.
Mm-hmm. So just not buying it. Rosalind, we really appreciate your call tonight. Thank you so much for calling in. Susan Shapiro-Barash, there's a very different view of the world saying, look, we've got all kinds of studies that say that it's not nearly as simple as this, and you're giving us a kind of anecdotal view of the world that's misrepresenting a lot of relationships. What do you say?
Well, I think that I know that my research is anecdotal, qualitative research, and I feel that the voices of these women are very real. But I'm also pretty familiar with the studies, and I think that the question of what the culture, what our society prescribes to women and men is a big part of it. And I think that, you know, if we look at even the 1950s, well, if we think of Betty Friedan and the feminist mystique, and her book came out, and suddenly women in suburbia said, gee, even though, the criticism is it was all white middle-class women, but their voices of these women, were strident, and they were saying, look, we really were stuck in these homes, and we really do want to do something more with our lives.
Get us out of here.
This is what we're supposed to do, yes. And that really started the rumblings.
Well,
and, so what are you told to do, and what do you really yearn to do
and
as a woman?
And what mate do you end up with, I guess, is the topic on the table tonight. Susan Shapiro-Barash, Stephen Rhodes, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about the buzz over new claims that men don't want high-achieving women. Callers, you can join us. Is this just a Hollywood story from Made in Manhattan or Love Actually? Or is this really the way of the world? What kind of men want to mate down, quote-unquote, the social and professional ladder? And professional women, give us a reality check here. What do you see in secretaries, nannies? How about for you? Is it raining men? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the buzz over new claims that men don't want high-achieving women, that they don't want the women we've been raising. You can join the conversation. What does all this mean? Is feminism fighting nature, or are some men, some women, just fighting the march of history, fighting the inevitable? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight by Susan Shapiro-Barash. She's author of The New Wife, The Evolving Role of the American Wife, by Stephen Rhodes, author of Taking Sex Differences Seriously, and now from Madison, Wisconsin, by Deborah Bloom, Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist, author of several books, including Sex on the Brain, The Biological Differences Between Men and Women. She's a professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin. Deborah Bloom, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So you're a journalist. You look at all these things. Help us make sense of this. I mean, we've got some very, very deeply conflicting claims here tonight from my good guests and good callers. We've got Maureen Dowd, No Mean Observer, saying that art and life these days are turning women who seek equality into selfish narcissists and objects of rejection rather than affection. What's going on here?
It's a lot of fun, isn't it? And one of the things that I always like to begin with is by saying, you know, we're talking about sex differences. We're not talking about cancer research. And what we really need to do to some extent is enjoy them because we are comfortably different at a whole lot of levels across a wide spectrum. And part of that is biology, and part of that is cultural behavior. Part of it is nature, part of it is nurture, and I always imagine them almost as people in a waltz. And one of the things that makes it so hard to figure out and why we fight about it so much is you can almost imagine two very assertive partners dancing, each of them wanting to take the lead. So they push and pull at each other all the time. Everyday life can cause your genes to express differently. There's terrific studies at NIH recently, actually, that show that if you're the nervous child of a nervous mother and they give you a different mother across, a foster mother who's very nice and nurturing, she will change the way your genes express. Serotonin will move differently in your brain. You will have a different biology because you had a different mother.
All right, so you've got a big embracing view and you're comfortable with it and you love the dance, but think about people are out there reading the results of these studies, perhaps an accomplished, ambitious, as yet unmarried woman who wants to be married. She's reading this and saying, oh my gosh, how am I going to find a partner?
Well, you know, at some level, I had Michigan send me this study, and you may have gone into the nitty-gritty of it. But when you look at the questions they asked, right, the relative dominant description versus the lower dominant description, Jennifer/John is your immediate supervisor. He is the person you report to on a daily basis.
Oh.
Has the responsibility for disciplining you, getting your poor performance.
I mean, who would want to marry the boss in that
setup?
Well,
you know, this is a very irritating Jennifer and John, and when I looked at it, I thought, you know, get a grip. How many of us say, oh, I'd really like to have the person who's charting my errors every day,
right. Especially
in this description. So when you get into this kind of social science, you really have to pull right down to the nitty-gritty and say, what does it say? And one of the real interesting things, just to, you know, dig in this one for a minute, is that it found a different pattern for women to go back to the sort of evolutionary biology thing. In general, you would predict that women would, in evolutionary biology, that women would go for that power guy with the money and the resources.
And the study did not find that. They were much more omnidirectional.
They did, because, in fact, you know, the power guy was like a big pain in the butt. And you were then having people react to this description. This is my take. Kind of personally, and I wouldn't be surprised, take this one with a grain of salt, that if it's not so much saying, I don't like powerful women based on this description, is saying, I don't like this nitpicking, nasty boss kind of person. I don't know if that's who I would pick.
So when you hear Dr. Stephanie Brown, who was the lead author of the study, she says, for reporters, powerful women are at a disadvantage in the marriage market because men may prefer to marry less accomplished women. You're saying no.
I'm saying that that's a great quote for a press release, but when I read the study, I kind of see a mixed message there. What I see is annoying bosses make a lousy partner.
And yet there's something going on here. Let's get a caller. Chris is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I want to totally agree with what your panel member just stated about the nitpicky person, because that is part of the reason why I remain unmarried at this point. I've dated women from Harvard Law and other powerful women, and when they express themselves the same way in the bedroom as in the boardroom, that really is a turnoff. And
you think powerful women are necessarily nitpicky and annoying to you?
Not necessarily, but when they don't understand that there is a difference between the castle and the outside world that you have to do battle with every day, sometimes a man does not want to hear the same stressors that he has on the outside when he gets into his home.
So are you drawing a big lesson away from that, Chris? Have you moved your search for a mate away from the power ranks and somewhere else?
Well, no, I haven't given up hope completely, but I'm trying to find a woman who understands that, as my mother says, you can get a man to do more through the back door than beating down his front door.
Well, okay, we'll think about that one. Chris, thanks very much for your call. Susan Shapiro-Barash, how about it? Do you see a kind of, I don't know, a balance point that people can aim for here? I mean, is it... Can you not be an accomplished, powerful woman and yet, as Chris, our caller, said, you know, sort of back inside the home, be expressing yourself in a way that's also loving and affectionate and not necessarily, you know, difficult?
I think that these relationships, to get back to that, dance idea, really have a dance of their own. And I think that there's a certain gamble in any marriage. And when you marry someone and you think you're on the same track and it seems to fit, it can change. I mean, we're hearing about that right now with Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt. I mean, everyone's speculating and curious about what happened. But sometimes a woman's needs seem to change more than a man's. And I think that has a lot to do with our culture. And perhaps the man will marry someone who is a secretary and she quits and she has no regrets. And then she wakes up a few years later and says, you know what, I want to go to law school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the woman he expected to marry. So, you know, maybe he tried to protect himself from the boss, and here he has someone who wants to be a boss somewhere.
And so she turns around and becomes a boss.
Right. So there, you know, there are no guarantees, but it's a constant, you know, movement forward for
the dance that Deborah Blum has for us here. Let's get a call. David's calling from Priest Lake, Idaho. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Thank you. Well, I was just wondering, kind of thinking here, it seems to me that the relationship between men and women, women have abilities to see and feel things intuitively, if you will, that men really can't. And likewise, I think men have the same ability, only in their own way. And it's only really together that they begin to learn and communicate and trust each other that they kind of become one. I mean, I don't want to get scripture or anything like that, but it just seems that that's the process by which a family unit, if you will, becomes stronger. Now,
so what does that say about whether men would look to a secretary or a supervisor as a mate?
Relative, I would think. You know, they're looking at us, both sides, we all seem to kind of share one thing in common, at least, several things in one kind of category, and that which motivates our behavior, love, fear, anger, greed, hate, avarice, lust, whatever, you know, those things that cause us to make decisions and do what we do. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, when you're ready to really go to battle for something one day and you think you've got all the answers,
yeah,
and you make all of your decisions based on what you're really certain, which is true and accurate, and then you get a piece of information 2 days later that you, where you find out that you were completely wrong about what you were thinking about the day before, obviously it sort of you come to a place where it takes time in a relationship to develop that oneness that I was talking about. And if you haven't gone down the road yet, and you haven't stuck it out yet, and you haven't gone through the thick and thin together yet, and you haven't come together in that place where you're both trusting each other's counsel, you know, it's pointless to be arguing about it.
You know, a lot of wisdom right there, David, and I know it well. Whatever the ingredients, sticking with it is a huge factor. Stephen Rhodes, you've been listening along for a while here. We've got callers making, you know, points from a lot of different angles here. The National Review looks at your research and says the feminist cause is floundering. Do you feel that that's what you actually – do you support that with your view? Or
I think there'll be a new kind of feminism, because I think you see it – you know, it's not just red states, blue states. It's Lisa Belkin in the New York Times. It's Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes talking about the most talented women who are saying that they want to drop out for a while and raise their kids, and therefore they're not going to have the same high-flying careers to quite the same extent as men, and they seem absolutely happy about it. And I think it is true what Deborah said. I agree with a lot of it. But what's interesting in the Michigan study even is these women didn't mind having this boss as their romantic married partner. In other words, the men did, the women didn't. They were neutral. They didn't find it attractive. But saying that this guy disciplined you wasn't a turnoff like it was for men. And I do think if you read Bridget Jones, all kinds of pop culture, there's all kinds of evidence that women like authoritative men. They like a man who kind of is at least an equal and maybe just a step ahead of them, maybe a little smarter, a little further along.
I don't know. Here I'm reading a letter to the editor, response to Maureen Dowd's Men Just Want Mommy. And the writer here is saying, what I noticed throughout college is that kind, funny, and intelligent men are attracted to equally or more intelligent, kind, and funny women. She says, maybe it's up to us feminists to breed with the good guys like crazy and then raise really great, secure, and intelligent boys, thereby bringing hope to the next generation. Stephen Rhodes?
Well, I think it's a certain kind of woman who's saying that. I think that, look, there's a lot of women who enjoy being homemakers, you know, who enjoy putting family first. And where I would disagree with that is when she says that these men like more intelligent, kind, and funny women than they are. I don't see that. I really don't see that in the literature, that when doctors, male doctors, they say they want their – they want their mate to be the same or less, and female doctors say the same or more. And these are, you know, this is true in all kinds of studies, I think.
Let's get one more call. Liz is calling from Rockford, Illinois. Hi, Liz. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. I haven't read the studies. I haven't read the literature. But from personal experience, I have a doctorate. My husband has a bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
And my experience is that marriage is a relationship between two people. The careers of the individuals in the relationship is one aspect of the relationship, but ultimately, marriage is a relationship between two people. And I think that the study, I'm not sure if it considered perceptions and attitudes towards marriage in general, as well as towards perceptions of the husband role and the wife role, because in my personal experience, we share everything jointly. We have two young children. We raise our children together. I'm not at home to raise my kids. He's not at home to raise his kids. It's our they're our children.
And is your husband intimidated by your PhD, Liz? Is that a problem for him?
Not at all. It has nothing, because bottom line, it has nothing to do with his intelligence and with his ability to work for the family and earn the family. I mean, we're an equal. We're equals with each other. Our degrees have nothing to do with our sense of self and our confidence and our sense of connection as equals.
Liz, we've got it. You're not going to get hung up on the diploma status war there. We appreciate your call. Deborah Blum, I wonder what you hear in this. On the one hand, are we, fine-tuning something here post the big surge of the early feminist decades, or are studies like this being picked up by cultural conservatives as a kind of club to beat back feminism?
You know, I mean, for me, what I look at it, and I think that we're an evolving monogamous species. If you look at human history, you'll see that we're sort of evolving toward, monogamy. Early humans were much more like polygamous species. You had that huge size differential of more than 50%. Mm-hmm. Monogamous species are exactly the same size, male and female. We've now come down to 17%. We are moving, but we are not there. And one of the things you see in a truly monogamous species, which we're not, is equal partnership. And you certainly see this in many of, like, say, the bird species or the other primate species. What I see us doing is culturally wrestling with this enormous change in who we are. We're yanked back by our history, right? Kind of like it's hard to break the habits of your childhood. Mm. This is a species habit, you know, men to prefer the wife who's going to be a good breeder and is younger and is fertile and all of those things, women to prefer the provider. You see that very early in primate history.
And yet underneath that, you see evolution moving, so we've got both going on. Really at the same time.
It's up to us to push it, right?
The old push-pull. Deborah Blum, we're out of time, but it's been great having you. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Deborah Blum, author of Sex on the Brain, and Stephen Rhodes, author of Taking Sex Differences Seriously. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
It's been a great pleasure.
And Susan Shapiro-Barash, author of The New Wife, The Evolving Role of the American Wife. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on pointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Like the feathered no man, the army.